The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. In July of 2022, Australia's first fixed-site drug-checking service, called CanTest, opened as a six-month pilot program in central Canberra. The program is delivered by Directions Health Services in partnership with the Canberra Alliance for Harm Minimization and Advocacy and Pill Testing Australia, and is funded by the Australian Capital Territory Government. CanTest builds on the two successful trials of drug checking at an event called the Groovin' the Moo Festival in Canberra in 2018 and 2019. On February 23rd, Australia's National Drug and Alcohol Research Centre held a webinar entitled Delivering the CanTest Health and Drug Checking Service. The featured speaker was Professor Mal McLeod with the Australian National University's College of Science.
So just start out, what is drug checking or pill testing? So it has a focus on public health and harm reduction. And what we do is we test drug samples that are provided by the public. And we return those results directly to the service users. And it's not just about providing an analytical test result. It's also about the interactions with the client. So the test result is the start of a conversation. It might be about their intentions for drug use or their experience. It might talk about the setting in which they intend to use the drug. And all of this is designed to improve the safety, I guess, of drug-taking behaviour. So, of course, to deliver this effectively, we need an environment where we have objective advice, non-judgmental approach to interacting with our clients, and this is really important. There are other things that drug checking can do other than improve the safety around drug use. It can also effectively monitor an unregulated drug market, and we'll see some examples of that later on. So this slide just shows, I guess, some of my background in this area as well. Recently returned from a Churchill Fellowship to Europe, where they've been doing drug checking for over 30 years. So at that time, I visited the Drug Information and Monitoring Centre in the Netherlands. You can see part of their annual report on the left, and also Cosmicare, both in Lisbon and at their festival drug checking service in Lisbon, and finally Check It in Austria. And my goal was to primarily look at the analytical technology involved in drug checking, but it also became very clear to me that drug markets are very different in different parts of the world. And so in developing a drug checking service, you must be adaptable and consider the local drug market. Okay, I'll tell you a little bit about the development of the CanTest fixed site health and drug checking service. And I'll start with a potted history of what's happened in the ACT. So, of course, drug checking, there's been a long advocacy by many, many organisations. But in recent history in the ACT, we've had the 2018 and 2019 trials of pill testing at Groovin' the Moo. The second of these was evaluated by a team led by Anna Olsen at the Australian National University. And resulting from this, the ACT government has published the festival's pill testing policy. And this document sets out guidelines for how to conduct pill testing ongoing in the ACT. So this is now established. Parallel to this, Directions Health Service, an alcohol and other drug provider in the ACT and other in the surrounding regions, developed a position paper on drug checking back in 2018. This led then to the development of a proposal that went to the ACT government in 2020, and later the budget allocation by the ACT government of funding to establish the CanTest Health and Drug Checking Service, a fixed site service. So there's a lot of work that went on behind the scenes in order to get things ready to go. We had to establish possible location, We had to negotiate all the processes and protocols associated with service delivery. There was contract and subcontract negotiation, and even licensing to handle prohibited substances and controlled medicines. The service was launched in July 2022, and the six-month pilot was scheduled to close in January 2023. And at that time, an interim evaluation report, which I'll talk a little bit more about later on, was released, and the ACT government extended our pilot for 6 months to August 2023. So we remain in business. So I'll just talk a little bit about the contributors to the six-month pilot. Firstly, of course, ACT Health and the ACT government for funding the pilot. The key players, of course, are Directions Health Service, services who hold the contract and are the service lead. Karma, who provide peer educators at the service and also community expertise on the local environment in Canberra. And of course, Pill Testing Australia, who I represent, who provide scientific and clinical expertise on aspects of drug checking. ANU School of Medicine and Psychology, Anna Olson is delivering an independent evaluation supported by ACT Health. We have the ACT Government Analytical Lab, who provide us with some quality assurance testing in the background. And of course, ANU Research School of Chemistry, where I work, who do also do some background analysis that we'll get to. So the photos at the bottom there on the left, Anna Olson, Steph, who we'll see later from Directions, and members of the ACT Health team. And bottom right is a photo from the Open. So on the left is Minister Rachel Stephen-Smith, Bronwyn Hendry from Directions, Chris Goff from Karma, and Jen Ross-King and David Caldicott from Pill Testing Australia. So let me tell you a little bit about the service and the client journey. So the service is staffed by chemical analysts, and we use graduate chemists to perform our chemical analysis. We have AOD counsellors, alcohol and other drug counsellors, and peer educators on site to talk with the clients. There's a registered nurse on site whenever the service is open to provide health interventions. There's an on-call GP or medical officer in case issues need to be escalated, and an on-call manager from Directions to manage any unexpected issues. The service is open 6 hours a week from 10 to 1 on Thursdays and 6 to 9 on Friday evenings. So what do the clients see when they arrive? Well, on the top right is a picture of our waiting room. The clients enter here and they're welcomed. Phones are stored in lockers, and this is to ensure client confidentiality. The clients then sign a waiver, which just explains some of the what we can and cannot do with the analysis on site. And then we collect some service data, basically demographic data and things of that nature, which are important for the service. The evaluation, there's a pre-test survey. This is optional. Clients can conduct their pre-test survey. They then move upstairs to do their testing and results. And you can see on the bottom left is the testing room there with our equipment, which I'll talk more about shortly. Following the testing, there's a handover of information between the analyst, the client, and the alcohol and other drug workers. At the conclusion of the visit, they're invited again to conduct an optional post-test survey. So that's the basic client journey. The methods of analysis we use, Fourier transform infrared, ultra performance liquid chromatography and fentanyl test strips. And of course, another powerful tool in our box, I guess, is client expectation. So we can measure our findings against client expectation. And this is something that's not generally available for things like the testing of amnesty bins or police seizures or even wastewater analysis. So there's some additional information that we have on hand. So let me tell you a little bit about our methods of analysis. The first of these is FTIR, or Fourier transform infrared analysis. And you can see the shoebox-sized instrument on the right-hand side of the screen there. So this uses infrared spectroscopy. It matches a sample spectrum to a large library of spectra for comparison, and it provides us with a score that indicates the quality of that match. And we have criteria for evaluating that score that gives us the confidence, I guess, in the quality of that match. FTIR is great. It's really good at distinguishing very closely related substances. And in some cases, we can even identify secondary components. But there, of course, there are limitations. We can't identify perhaps all components in a sample. And this is qualitative, not quantitative information. So we're not giving information about sample purity using this technique. You can see the pictures across the bottom and the compound names there. This is a little test analysis of a sample of closely related substances. And what you can see from the scores underneath there, the scores out of 1,000, is that these scores are all relatively high, and we can use these scores to clearly distinguish between all of these closely related substances. So it's a really useful technique. The second mode of analysis is ultra-performance liquid chromatography photodiode array analysis. And the instrument on the right is substantially bigger than a shoebox, and it was generously provided by Waters Australia, our analytical partners, in the CanTest pilot. So UPLC can separate different drug components in time. It can identify them by looking at the UV visible spectrum, and it can even report on the purity for 10 targeted drugs, all in under 3 minutes. So the figure to the bottom left shows 10 target drugs there, those little bumps. Each of those is for one of our 10 targets. The figure in the middle is just to show that we calibrate our instrument routinely, and we use this then to provide the clients with the purity of the drug in their sample. Now, this instrument can also detect adulterants, so things that aren't on our 10 targeted drugs. We can see these, often see these by UPLC analysis, and there's a growing number of substances that can be identified in this way, but not quantified. And in the duration of the pilot, we've done something like 400 tests using this instrument. It's been incredibly valuable. The last method of analysis is fentanyl test strips. And so we use fentanyl test strips from BTNX in Canada. These were originally developed for urinary analysis of fentanyl and metabolites, but they've been used off-label for harm reduction purposes. And there are a number of references at the bottom of the screen that you can follow to see that in action. So they're a lateral flow immunoassay for fentanyl and derivatives. And thanks to COVID, it's easy to explain because it's like a rapid antigen test or RAT for fentanyl. And the only wrinkle in that is that two lines is negative here and one line is positive. So we have to keep that in mind.
That was Professor Mal McLeod with the Australian National University's College of Science speaking on a webinar entitled Delivering the CanTest Health and Drug Checking Service that was held February 23rd by Australia's National Drug and Alcohol Research Centre. The video is on YouTube, but it's unlisted. You can find it by going through the NDARC website, which is ndarc.med.unsw.edu.au. Okay, yeah, that is kind of a long URL. I shared the video on the Drug Policy Facts Facebook page. If you're still on Facebook, you can find the link there. We'll have more in a moment. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. From the island now referred to as Australia, we turn to the northern part of Abya Yala that's now referred to as Canada. The National Safer Supply Community of Practice is a knowledge exchange initiative led by the London, Ontario Intercommunity Health Centre in partnership with the Canadian Association of People Who Use Drugs and the Alliance for Healthier Communities. Its goal is to scale up safer supply programs across Canada. As explained on their website, quote, Safer Supply is a harm reduction-driven public health approach that involves the provision of a pharmaceutical drug supply of known quantity and quality to adults who use illegal drugs and who are at high risk of overdose and other harms. End quote. It's a simple concept. It is a medicalized program, and it is limited. Again, from the National Safer Supply Community of Practice website, quote, Most importantly, medicalized approaches to safer supply are only safer right now because the guidelines and policies of current programs, including dosages and protocols, do not adequately or appropriately address the expressed needs of people who use drugs who are accessing these programs. Because these guidelines do not adequately address these expressed needs, people who use drugs must rely on toxic drug supplies to get what they need in order to feel well, putting them at risk of drug poisoning and overdose. Ultimately, the term safe supply came from activist groups of people who use drugs, and the medical model is simply not what they were referring to and envisioning in their demands for safe supply. End quote. Loyal listeners will be familiar with the concepts of safe supply and safer supply. We've had some of the activists working on actual safe supply on the show in the past, like Eris Nix and Jeremy Callicum from the Drug User Liberation Front. Well, DULF is just one of the groups working to provide safe supply. They're located in Vancouver. Another organization, also in BC, is the Kootenay Insurrection for Safe Supply, an advocacy and direct action collective working to bring accessible, non-medicalized safe supply to the Nelson region. The founder of the Kootenay Insurrection is Dylan Griffith. He was the featured speaker on a National Safer Supply Community of Practice webinar held February 23rd, entitled Empowering Choice, Expanding Options for Safer Supply in Rural and Remote Communities. Let's hear a little of that.
So I'm going to do a quick presentation on where we're at with KISS and what it's all about. It's going to be pretty rapid fire because I've got about 20 minutes to get through this so we can have a really long and great conversation with the whole panel. So we'll be moving quickly. Just first off, with the territorial acknowledgement, I want to respectfully acknowledge that we live, learn, rest, and play as uninvited settlers on the unceded traditional and ancestral territories of the Kanaka, Siksika, Saanich, and Shakopik peoples in what is colonially recognized as the Kootenay region of British Columbia. So KISS, how did it all start? What's it all about? It was founded in the spring of 2020, basically in response to my dissatisfaction with everything that was going on in British Columbia specifically, but certainly with drug policy, the lack of movement around safe supply and any real response to the drug poisoning crisis at all. It was very much inspired by the work of Dolphin Vandu, as well as the Overdose Prevention Society, and ACT UP as well was a really fantastic model of sort of combining that, the activism and really smart engagement with science and with the political policymakers. And why I thought this project would be a good fit was a lot of that had to do with being situated in Nelson. Nelson has, for a rural community, has a long history of really innovative and pioneering harm reduction. Anchors, which is our primary harm reduction agency, was started here in 1993. Drug checking harm reduction program that Anchors runs at Shambhala started around 2001. REDUN, the Rural Empowered Drug Users Network, drug user group that's now in Nelson, Castlegar, Trail, and Grand Forks, was started in 2004. Anchors opened up an overdose prevention site, and I believe that was the first rural site in 2018, and that is still the only OPS between Calgary and Kelowna. There will be one opening up in Cranbrook soon, but that's not quite there yet. 2018, Anchors fundraised, community fundraised by their own FTIR spectrometer, and Shambhala kicked in 10 grand for that as well. We also have an EOPS program that REDUN runs on Friday and Saturday nights. And we have prescribers, which our neighboring communities don't so much. So we have two existing prescribed safe supply programs in Nelson that we'll be hearing from representatives of both those programs a little later. Trail only has one very overworked physician prescribing safer supply. And Castlegar, and these are both very close to us. If you don't know the geography here, they're Trail's about an hour away and Castlegar is half an hour away. Castlegar has no one prescribing safer supply at all. So we're a bit of an island in this region in terms of the services we have here. And so yeah, there's a real culture of harm reduction and of course the drug poisoning and both the drug poisoning crisis and the housing crisis have really hit this region hard. We've had 138 deaths in the Kootenay Boundary region since 2016, which doesn't include people who from Nelson who have passed away outside of the community, which is a significant number of people. There's a lot of migration in this region as there is throughout the province. So that number doesn't quite capture the full picture of the loss. Look at that. So the vision was to establish a non-medicalized drug user-led safe supply compassion club in Nelson. And the reasons for doing this was to protest the lack of meaningful action, as we said, to demonstrate that such a club is needed, effective, and feasible in a rural and remote community. The drug crisis isn't as visible here for a lot of people, so it's a bit of a harder sell. People don't see the intensity of the crisis the way they do in major urban centers, and so they don't necessarily see the need for such a radical solution as a safe supply compassion club. It was also done as a test case for other groups to learn from, improve upon, and build so they can start their own programs, specifically rural communities. This is very much in the tradition of how we started ours, which is based on the DELF model. They published all their stuff, their work on their website, so we were able to build off that. And so we want to do the same and provide that resource to other communities. And also, it started as a foundation upon which to build and expand non-medicalized peer-led safe supply options in the region. We're starting off unsanctioned, but our hope is that we will be in it for the long haul and eventually become a sanctioned drug user group run compassion club that's accessing substances through legal channels. So the rationale for why a non-medicalized safe supply program. Stigma and discrimination are still huge barriers in healthcare and accessing healthcare for people who use drugs. And that's certainly true of prescribed safe supply as well. There's always going to be a segment of the drug user population who are not going to access prescribed safe supply because of previous experiences with healthcare and ongoing stigma within the healthcare system. A lot of our users and our REDA members talk about throughout the whole region, talk about the prescriber model as being paternalistic and punitive. And the alternative to that is the non-medicalized model, which is often seen as more empowering and that it has places greater value on autonomy and self-determination. So jumping ahead to the slide that already appeared, the strategy, follow the DELF model. We basically took the DELF framework that they published and adapted that. And that was the basis for the work we're doing. And then on top of that, because we, as I said, we don't have the intensity of the crisis here. It's not as visible. So we really have to do work around building public support for a safe supply compassion club and for the work we're doing. So we do that through strategic partnerships, dialogue with the drug using community, and then public education and engagement initiatives throughout the region. Like a bunch of this stuff here. So we did a screening of Love and the Time of Fentanyl. We've been doing presentations at Selkirk College to various healthcare classes, the nursing program, the rural pre-med program, the health and human services program, which has been really fantastic, getting those healthcare workers right when they're in school and talking to them about stigma, talking to them about harm reduction. Those kids know it. They are totally on board with harm reduction. It's been such an inspiring and really energizing part of the work we're doing. The template. So we use the same basic logistical framework that DELF uses, which is we purchase drugs online, get them tested at Substance, which is at the University of Victoria, and then we package and distribute to our members at cost. The details of how our Compassion Club will run, we can't share. And we'll get into why that is a little bit later, but basically the unsanctioned nature of the project and being in a tight-knit, small rural community makes it, we can't be out in the open the way DELF is, we'll put it that way. So as I said, the vision I should add to the Compassion Club was not only do we want to establish a Compassion Club, but we want to make sure that it's ethical and sustainable. And the ethics of this project was something that Amber and I talked about. Amber Strukins, who is will be introduced to in a little bit. And Amber, if you want to jump in at any point with any of this stuff, please do. Yeah, the ethics of what we're doing were really important, and we'll talk about that quite a bit as we go along here. So the main obstacles to starting the Compassion Club in this setting, the unsanctioned status of what we're doing is one of the two big obstacles. And this has all kinds of repercussions. It prevents any of our allies, any established organizations in the community from publicly or materially supporting our work at all, because it threatens their funding and it threatens the programs that already exist. So we have a lot of support in the community, but none of that support is out in the open and none of that support is material. It prevents us from fundraising. We can't really be actively fundraising because we don't want to have that high public profile at this point. And that's challenging. We have not been able to access any physical space. We can't rent a space, and no one can let us share their space for the reasons we talked about, because it threatens their funding, it threatens their programming, it threatens their reputation in the community to be associated with a unsanctioned program like ours. And then there's the threat of being shut down. So we have no guarantees that we will run for any length of time. And this presents a real ethical dilemma, because we're presenting members of the Compassion Club with this sort of the proposal that by accessing the safe supply with us, it'll lead to all these benefits, including greater stability, and they're no longer accessing the tainted drug supply. So there's much greater safety, less risk of overdose. And to have that yanked away with no notice can be hugely destabilizing. So that's something that we've really been concerned about. And it's led us to sort of slow things down quite a bit. And we need to have some guarantees in place as much as we can that we're going to be able to move forward and run the club with a reasonable expectation that we will not be shut down for a significant period of time. And we'll talk a bit more about what that looks like in a minute. And then the other threat from being shut down is it'll create all kinds of legal and financial problems. So basically, as I said, we couldn't do any fundraising. So this is self-financed for now. If we get shut down right away, it's going to cost me a lot of money. The other big challenge of the small of our setting is the lack of anonymity in a small, tight-knit community. So the identities of our study participants and our Compassion Club members will be known in the community very quickly. It's just people talk. It's a small town. It'll get out. And so that creates all kinds of problems, potential for people to be targeted for harassment, for theft, for violence, targeted by the police. It makes it more dangerous for us as providers being known in the community and being identified that way. So that's a real issue. Challenges around confidentiality and comfort and safety with peer research assistants. So we're doing a study, which we'll talk about in a minute, along with the Money and the Compassion Club. And so there's a lot of very personal questions and very sensitive questions asked in that study. And, you know, it's a community that knows each other. It's a community with a lot of familiarity. And it's very easy to slip into, to let things slip and sort of get those, what's the word I'm looking for? The barriers, to forget the boundaries, sorry, is the word I'm looking for, around confidentiality. And then safety and security concerns for project team members, as I mentioned earlier.
That was Dylan Griffith, founder of the Kootenai Insurrection for Safe Supply, speaking on a National Safer Supply Community of Practice webinar February 23rd, entitled Empowering Choice, Expanding Options for Safer Supply in Rural and Remote Communities. The National Safer Supply Community of Practice has a lot of great resources on their website, which is nss-aps.ca. I'll continue to help amplify their messages and voices, but you should definitely check them out. There is so much that's possible if we just move past the question of what we can do within the narrow constraints of the current system, and instead ask, what should we be doing? Safe supply, safe consumption spaces, decriminalization, decolonization. And well, that's it for now. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Find this edition of Century along with an archive of past shows at the Drug Truth Network website, drugtruth.net. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is
for the Drug Truth Network. This is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.